Hello, everyone.
There is an alarm.
All right, here we are. Good evening, everyone. I hope everyone got a seat, and if not, you're making a new friend here at Michigan Radio Issues and Ale. Hi, my name is Steve Kropinski. I'm the marketing director at Michigan Radio. I want to thank you all for coming out this evening on a beautiful Tuesday evening here. We know it's a bit cozy. We do have a couple seats up here, a couple bar stools, if anybody needs that. And if you have, if you're at a table and you have an empty seat next to you, raise your hand. Okay, so there are a couple in the back. So as we get other people coming in, we will definitely have you make a new public radio friend. So we're glad you're joining us here for our Issues and Ale. First time we've ever been here at Perrin Brewing Company. How about a big round of applause for Perrin Brewing for hosting us tonight? Let me ask, how many of you, this is your first time at Perrin Brewing? Raise your hand. All right, fair number of you. And how many of you, this is your first time ever at a Michigan Radio Issues and Ale discussion? Okay, we have a lot of first-timers here. So let me just explain how this works. Issues and Ale is a discussion series that we host at Michigan Radio all across the state, looking at different issues that are in the news, things that we think are important, things that people have weighed in on that they would like to get more information about. So this is a very informal discussion. We have always determined that sometimes it's a lot easier to have the medicine go down if you have a good IPA in your hand. But again, it's a very informal discussion, so feel free during the event if you need to get up, you want to go order something else to eat or get something to drink. Obviously, there's wait staff here. It's fine for you to do that. We're going to have a discussion. We're going to have lots of time for your question and answers as well. So we'll get to that a little bit later on. Before we start, let me just let you know about a couple upcoming events that are going on. Our next Issues and Ale discussion is going on in actually 2 weeks. We're going to be on the other side of the state. We're going to be in Flint, but some of you may have heard we are welcoming the StoryCorps mobile trailer to Flint for the month of August. They're going to be there recording the stories of people in and around Flint. So we're going to be there on Monday, August 5th. At the Flint Farmers Market, Lester Graham will be hosting a discussion we're calling Inside StoryCorps. So it's basically a discussion with the producers and staff of StoryCorps about what it's like traveling the country in that big, shiny, silver Airstream trailer, recording conversations with people all across the country. So if you happen to be in Flint on Monday, August 5th, we hope you'll join us there at the Flint Farmers Market. Also, speaking of Lester Graham, as many of you know, Lester hosts the Environment Report, and although it is really toasty here in West Michigan today and has been for the last few weeks, I have it on good authority that winter will return to Michigan at some point. And what would be better than spending 10 days of February than traveling to Costa Rica with Lester Graham? So we are hosting a Michigan Radio listener trip. We're calling Discover Costa Rica with Michigan Radio in late February. There is information as you walked in by the hostess stand there. There are little flyers like this as information about the trip. These are listener trips we have started doing. In fact, as we speak right now, Cynthia Canty of Stateside is hosting a group of listeners in France for 2 weeks. So this will be our next listener trip coming up in February to Costa Rica, hosted by Lester Graham. So if you're thinking about a getaway, a winter getaway from Michigan, why don't you consider joining a group of Michigan Radio listeners for that trip? So we are recording tonight's event, and we'll be using this wireless mic when we get to the Q&A portion. My assistant, Chrissy Zamarin, is here. She'll be coming by. So if you have a question or comment, just raise your hand, and we'll come by. That way, everyone hopefully can hear your question, and we'll get it on the recording as well. Also joining us tonight is Chelsea Roberts, who's way in the back. Chelsea is a member of our Michigan Radio Corporate Support Team, is there. And also here, Rusty Brock is handling our audio for the evening. Those of you who listen to Stateside on Friday know that Lester Graham usually makes some snide remark about Rusty Brock, totally undeserving. So we'll see if any of that happens today as well.
It's always true.
Always true, exactly. So our host this evening is Lester Graham. He is not only the host of the Environment Report, but also the host of Stateside on Fridays. He has a long history of covering environmental stories in the Great Lakes regions, going back more than two decades, which is just sort of my way of saying, just like me, he is really old. So without further ado, let me introduce Lester Graham.
Hi there. Hi there, big crowd. Glad you all can make it. I got a couple of requests, though. I was going to sit up here in a jacket. I don't want to do that. Is that okay? Can I loosen up the damn tie, too? Is that okay? All right, great. Let's do that. All right, I want to introduce my guest here first. You might have read a lot of his work over the years. 3 years now he's been covering PFAS issues, at least 3 years. Garrett Ellison is an environmental reporter with MLive Media Group. You first started covering PFAS in 2016, is that right?
I was up around Wurtsmith Air Force Base, and then
in Escoda Township up there, yeah.
Mm-hmm, up in northern Michigan, and then I wrote some stuff about contamination in the Plainfield Township water supply in 2016, and that was before the Wolverine stuff sort of became known.
Tell people real quickly how you found out about the Wolverine stuff.
Well, there was a woman who sent me an email one day in July. I think she's here today. And, just said, hey, I thought you've read a lot of the stuff that you've written, and I thought you might want to know there's potentially a source for these chemicals in the Rockford area. And, if you'd like to come meet me at the Rockford Dam, I can show you a few things. And that's kind of, it's gone along a lot farther from there, but that's sort of how it started.
Yeah, journalists like, they like news tips, that's for sure. Next to Garrett is Abby, right? Abby Hendershot. She's the district supervisor with the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. That's the last time I'll be saying it. It's going to be Eagle for the rest of the night. And she's contributed to water quality investigations and PFAS education across the state. Welcome.
Thank you.
And then we have Rick Radusky. He's an environmental toxicology and chemistry professor at Grand Valley State University and environmental chemistry senior program manager at the Robert B. Annis Water Resources Institute. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
All right, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to briefly, because most of you folks are pretty familiar with PFAS, but just in case there are a few of you who don't know what the heck we're talking about, we're going to briefly talk about what are these substances. We're talking about per and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS, P-F-A-S. It's a group of about 4,000 chemicals, although we only measure for PFOS, P-F-O-S, and PFOA, and that's the biggest concern right now because it was the most often used. So let's real briefly, each of you, tell us how these chemicals come about and why are they a problem?
Let me start.
Okay. The chemicals were kind of devised... Okay, the chemicals were first devised during the Manhattan Project, and when you start enriching uranium, it involves using fluorine, and fluorine is extremely corrosive, so they had to develop certain chemicals to be resistant to that very corrosive chemistry of separating uranium, the uranium isotopes. So it was used in the Manhattan Project. It was kind of kept secret for a while, but then both 3M and DuPont started producing products from that, and Teflon and other very common chemicals came out of that. So they're typically referred to as emerging contaminants, but they've really been in the environment, since the 50s. So it's a not just one single compound. It's, as Lester said, it's a group of compounds, and we've kind of migrated away from longer chain ones. The longer the carbon chain is, the more they accumulate in the body, to shorter chain ones, and those are excreted in the body from the body, but they also cause toxicity. So we have a whole suite of chemicals, 5,000 plus, with very limited toxicity information.
So from the environment perspective, we've only been, part of the reason it's called an emerging contaminant is because we've really only been studying this in Michigan for the last 6 years, specifically in North Kent County for the last three. And so as Rick says, this stuff is in a whole host of...
Abby, hold your mic just a little closer or we're going to get some feedback.
This is a little bit... Okay. It's in a whole host of chemicals and products that we use in our everyday world. And so the potential for us to come in contact this is very high. And we have incidental PFAS ingestion that may happen and occur through our day. What we're most worried about is those PFAS exposures that might happen mostly through drinking water. So the big, story for the Wolverine Project was that we had so many people with private drinking water wells that did end up having PFAS in them. And so ingestion is the major route of exposure for PFAS. And we are, focused on that. And obviously the science has developed quite a bit in the last couple of years, but there's still an awful lot of stuff that we don't know about it. Still looking at how PFAS and the toxicity affects fish, affects our rivers, affects our groundwater, how it moves through the environment. There's an awful lot of stuff that we still have to learn. But this is a big, complex group of family of chemicals that is really just, we're just getting to the tip of the iceberg on.
And part of the reason that it's a concern is because it was used in so many different products. You know, we know about waterproofing shoes, right? We know about firefighting foam. We know about some of those things. But it's been used in food packaging. It's been used in all kinds of different chemicals. It's really these compounds are really helpful. I mean, because they can stop a greasy hamburger from making the wrapper greasy looking. All these different things that we use them. Waterproofing couches, stain-proofing couches, waterproofing raincoats, things like that. So it's likely there's not a person here right now who doesn't have a PFAS in their blood. We've been exposed to it for decades, and there's really no getting around it. We'll talk a little later about some of the things we can do to stop exposure, but really it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere, and there's no getting out of it. Talk a little bit, because you've probably spent more time running around the state to these PFAS hotspots. Talk about some of the different industry uses that you've run into as you found out about more contaminated public water supplies.
Sure. I guess one of the big ones that we're noticing in Michigan right now is that the chrome plating industry seems to account for a pretty large percentage and seem to be growing every day of the list of sites that have groundwater contamination or have been discharging contaminated effluent to a wastewater treatment plant, which for the most part, no wastewater treatment plant in Michigan is equipped to filter this stuff out. So it ends up going into the treated discharge that goes to a river or into the biosolid sludge, which has then for a long time been land applied on farm fields as a type of fertilizer. So the plating industry, which is obviously part of the auto manufacturing supply chain, it seems to be a pretty big contributing industry to the contamination issue. And interestingly enough, they were required to use these compounds as a fume suppressant in the plating baths, right? So the chromium, which is a carcinogen, they would pour the PFOS variant of the PFAS family into the plating baths, and that would keep the vapors down. And that was done as a occupational measure to keep the workers from inhaling cancer causing fumes. So there's that. Obviously there are some chemical manufacturers in Michigan, not enormous ones. Other than the big one we're all aware of. But there's some smaller manufacturers over in the Metro Detroit Detroit area who I think have been identified as, sending either contaminated effluent to the wastewater systems or potentially groundwater contamination. There's, I think, a paint manufacturer or industries that would say fill aerosol cans with Scotchgard, or they would fill fire suppression systems, so the AFFF firefighting foam, which is the, sometimes referred to as the Class B foam, that, would be used at airports and municipal fire departments and military facilities. I'm sure there's more here. There's really so many. Firefighting foam, I think, is the one that most people tend to have heard of for the most part, because it's getting a lot of attention, not just in Michigan, but nationwide. But based on some of the comments I've heard our state fire marshal make, it doesn't appear to be the largest percentage of the problem in Michigan. I think what we're seeing in Michigan is that private industry is appearing to make up a larger percentage of the contamination than firefighting foam.
So why are we just now hearing about this? You talked about, there's a document written by the former MDEQ, and you discovered that through the Freedom of Information Act request. Why didn't we know about it more then, when that report was issued, because it seems like it was just shelved, and why has it taken decades to get to this point where we find out it's an issue?
Mm-hmm. You want me to take that one?
Actually, Abby,
you want me to take it?
Yeah, I want to ask about the report especially. Why wasn't that? I don't want to say it was ignored, but it really didn't come to the forefront of anybody's attention, it doesn't appear.
Yeah, no, that's a fair question. And I, honestly wasn't in the room when that thing made it up to the upper echelons of DEQ at the time. But I can, I'll give you my best summarization and guess on what was happening. One, at the point that it was written, we didn't have any regulations. We had no enforceable standards for PFOS or PFOA at the time. EPA hadn't come out with their lifetime health advisory, so there was nothing for us to regulate against, and there was no cleanup standard to use for us to be able to enforce our state laws at the time. So it's very tough for us to go to any kind of a manufacturer or an industrial facility and say, you've contaminated the groundwater, you need to clean it up, but we can't tell you how much you need to clean it up. So that puts us in a very tough position. So I think at the time the report was written, we acknowledged that there was going to be an issue, but without having some federal regulations to go with it, I think that management at the time probably were grappling with how to best deal with it.
Rick, we've known about PFOA and PFOS for quite a while. I mean, we had an incident where they were making Teflon products, right, in West Virginia. We also know that 3M has been dealing with exposure to employees. We've known for a few decades now that there's a problem.
Yeah, the 3M decided to discontinue the use of PFOS and PFOA. Those are eight-chain carbon compounds. And they decided to discontinue that in 2002. So DuPont kept producing it up until 2015. So they were given a much longer phase-out. And the reason why 3M decided to phase out of it was that they realized it was accumulating in animals all over the world. There was a study out of Michigan State that showed it was accumulating in birds in the Arctic, and it was accumulating in humans. That all that information was found much earlier, but the real fatal flaw with the whole regulation of PFAS was it was never put on the RCRA list of hazardous materials. So even though companies decided to phase out of it, there was bans of it in Europe, it still is not on the hazardous material list. So for whatever reason, it's been, there's a loophole where people can, it's not regulated, so there's no special procedures to control it. Yeah.
So even today, there's still no federal standard for cleanup of PFOA PFOS or PFOA at EPA level, and so we still grapple with how to handle, you know, obviously Department of Defense sites and many of the other facilities that are subject to federal jurisdiction.
The state is now working on trying to establish its own safe drinking water level, though, right?
Yeah, that is true. We're currently in the process of the Michigan PFAS Action Response Team has put out and given their science advisory group has put together recommendations for six or seven different PFAS chemicals that are all in the process of potentially getting an MCL set for by the fall. But that's got to go through some additional review and study.
Back up and tell us what MCL is.
Yes. So under the Safe Drinking Water Act, an MCL is the maximum contaminant level that can be legally allowed in a municipal water supply for people to be able to drink and be safe. But it's also a combination of not only the health-based drinking water that would be acceptable and not, you know, cause cancer or other things, but it's also got to be something that the municipal wastewater or municipal water plants can actually meet. So if they're bringing in surface water, treating it to serve as drinking water, they've got to be able to meet those standards. It's got to be economically feasible. They've got to have treatment technology to be able to meet it. So there's other things that go into the development of what they call an MCL. But it's usually done at the federal level. This would be the first MCL that Michigan would have set on our own. Usually we adopt all of the MCLs from the federal, from EPA.
And we're not the first state to do that because there has been no progress at the federal level. So some other states have decided, well, look, we've got to figure this out somehow. And they've got scientists, right? You know? One of the things that's really interesting about this set of chemicals is that they're called persistent, basically forever chemicals. So what kind of complications does that cause for any state, whether it's a body of water like a river or a groundwater? What kind of issues are we going to be dealing with?
Can I jump in?
Yeah, sure.
So I think this is one where, from the state's perspective, from Eagle's perspective, is really complicated for us, because usually we look, when we do cleanups, we look at what's it going to take, you know, as these chemicals would biodegrade over time, how much, you know, resources and restrictions would we need to put on to make sure that our populations are protected as they may use those properties. What's difficult about this is we're talking about something that is a perpetuity type of situation. We've got to protect our residents into the future forever if we've already got PFAS contamination in the soils and in the groundwater. And so that just gives us a whole different set of challenges than we've ever had to deal with on a different type of contaminant.
What are the health concerns?
Well, you know, that's kind of the big question everybody is sort of grappling with. There are definitely known associations between PFAS exposure and, you know, health outcomes. You know, I think a lot of this was sort of developed through the what's known as the C8 study in Parkersburg, West Virginia. That was the DuPont contamination of the Ohio River, where multiple communities were drinking from that river. And off the top of my head, I'm going to miss some of these, but kidney and testicular cancer, ulcerative colitis. There's been some pregnancy complications such as preeclampsia or pregnancy-induced hypertension.
Here, let me give you a cheat sheet here.
Perfect. high cholesterol and immune system effects, particularly for children. And you know, I think a lot of this is derived from the C8. But you know, if you're really interested in this stuff, and you're a little maybe skeptical of some of these claims of around uncertainty, right? Because you hear a lot about, well, this is uncertain. We don't know what the health effects are. Well, you know, there is some degree of certainty around this. And if you go to the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, the acronym is ATSDR. That's basically the toxicology arm of the CDC. BC. They have a pretty good page that lays out, you know, what's more or less known right now about associations with illness. And, you know, I think, you know, thyroid problems is one of the big ones. And so, you know, there's a lot of discussion around, you know, hey, we're still studying this. We don't necessarily know what all the health effects are. But there is definitely some things known, and I encourage anybody who has those questions to, you know, take a stop at the ATSDR page first before you start going elsewhere.
And what I'd like to add too on the toxicity, these compounds behave very differently than most traditional chemicals that we're concerned about in the environment. Mercury binds to our muscles and it doesn't really circulate in our blood. PCBs and DDT, the pesticide types, go into our fatty tissue, and again, they don't typically circulate. The PFAS chemicals bind to albumin in our blood, and albumin is the main protein that you know, helps us grow, so it's circulated throughout all of our organs, and it carries the antibodies. So when you're given a vaccination, those antibodies stick to the albumin and are circulated around. So you have something that's competing with the major protein in our body that's used to circulate a lot of hormones and other chemicals. So it's really much more complicated than trying to look at toxicity of other materials that we've been exposed to or we've looked at in the past. The other big differentiation is these larger PFAS compounds. The human kidney does not excrete them. So if we dose humans with levels of PFAS compounds and we dose rats with levels of PFAS compounds, the rats excrete it within 30 days. We hold on to it for 3 to 5 years. So we get much higher exposures. So the ability for us to do toxicity tests, we can't compare a rat or a rabbit toxicity test to a human just because we retain it so much. So these are really different, and it's very problematic to study them because the human is so much, human physiology is so different from all the other laboratory models.
Rick, you've mentioned a couple of times about the long chain, molecular long chain, and short chain chemicals in the PFAS family. But is there any evidence that short chain is any less worrisome than the long chain?
Yeah, that's the big issue. There was a paper that was just published in the last week about that, and less bioaccumulative or less persistent in the human body does not mean it's safe. It still does get into the human body, and it still can react with other biomolecules. So even though the fact that it's the lower chains are excreted, we're seeing toxicity for Gen X. That's the other big one that's in North Carolina. Even though that's excreted, you can't really measure it in high concentrations in the blood. It still is causing immune problems and other issues.
So a lot of these companies are switching to short chain with the idea that it might be safer.
Yeah. It's less persistent. It's not retained by humans, but it's still showing a toxicity profile. Yeah.
You know, the language that you see, I think, on, like, say, the DuPont website for, you know, some of their fluorotelomer, you know, surfactants, you know, is more environmentally friendly. You know, they don't say it's less toxic. They say it's more environmentally friendly. And I think that's largely due to the fact that they don't, you know, there is some study that shows the short chain. So, you know, the three to four to five carbon molecules do not persist, you know, like the six, seven, and eight chain carbon molecules do, such as the compound PFOS, right? That's a eight chain referred, you know, it's one of the long chain ones, and that seems to be the most persistent, that's from what I can understand.
I want to talk about government response to this, and I will say that at the beginning, when this started coming out through Garrett's reporting, mm-hmm. the state was a little skeptical, but suddenly he did enough work and showed the evidence and proved to state officials that Governor Snyder at the time decided we need to work on this, and he set up this team, this MPART team. So by all accounts, Michigan is ahead of other states in dealing with this, even though it seems like a crisis and we're seeing more of it and more of it. It's basically because the state's actually looking for that. Is that not correct?
Yeah, that's very correct. And a lot of the other states around the country have just not even started to look. But because of, and centrally because of Garrett's reporting and because of the contamination and the citizens group in Rockford, we have basically uncovered this issue that became so large that it garnered not only the attention of our governor and our state, but also the, you know, basically the world. And so we've had this unfortunate opportunity to take this and start a opportunity to not only get funding to do it, but the governor set up this Michigan PFAS Action Response Team, which allowed us to basically get all of the government, all of the state agencies onto one team to really coordinate a statewide effort that transcends all of our agencies, which is really unheard of. We've never done that before for that particular issue. So if we've got an airport that's using AFFF, then we can also talk to MDOT. We can talk to the Fire Marshals Association. We can talk with all of these different agencies and be able to do a coordinated response, which really helped out our efforts in Rockford and in North Kent County, but has also then led to statewide municipal drinking water sampling, has led to, which, you know, that accounted right there for 75% of the drinking water for the state. So huge amount of work has gone into in the last 2 to 3 years, and we've really uncovered now we've got a baseline for what PFAS exposure kind of looks like in our state. Is it getting into our surface water? Is it getting into our fish? Is it getting into our drinking water? So I still think we've got a lot of residential wells that need to be tested, but we've got a pretty good baseline to understand what's going on, and I think that's the difference between it looks like a crisis here, but in reality, there are a lot of other states that have similar issues. They just haven't uncovered them yet.
I want to ask, so anybody who's been exposed to this knows they've been exposed to this. Is probably more than a little concerned about what are the health impacts. I got an email this week from a gentleman who couldn't make it to this meeting, but he wanted to ask this question. Now, it's a long email. I'm just going to pull out these three paragraphs real quickly. We lived in a house near the Wolverine House Street dump site, which had the third highest levels of PFAS from 1997 to 2012. In other words, a 15-year period, we sold the property to current residents 5 years before the discovery of the issue. He says he's attended meetings regarding PFAS dumping. He's talked to Kent County Health Department and Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. And in his opinion, their attitude is, we don't know that PFAS causes health problems. If we did, there's nothing we can do about them, and we don't want to look too hard to see if there's really a problem. He goes on to say that he wants to know why he shouldn't be tested, be told what his levels are, and you know, is there any kind of treatment for a health issue that might not be related to PFAS levels, and show that there's a conclusive link between PFAS and any disease? So that's a lot.
Yeah.
Anybody who wants to address this, please do. But people are clearly concerned. This guy and his family exposed to it for 15 years, not currently exposed to it, but yeah. It's still. He wants to know: are we safe?
So I'll take the first half of that. So we get that question quite a bit because obviously the real estate market in Northern Kent County is still going crazy, and there's a lot of people buying and selling. And people who have lived in these homes for a significant amount of time, that's, you know, not an unreal request. I think that's a very realistic and very appropriate. And so the first exposure assessment that's going on in North Kent County right now is for those people who are living in those homes. They know they were exposed. We can test both their take samples of their blood as well as their drinking water. That's what they're calling the exposure assessment. There's a second phase that is underway right now. Kent County Health Department and Department of Health and Human Services have applied to be part of the national PFAS study. So if we can get Northern Kent County involved in that, then that's the place where it would be appropriate for those kinds of homeowners who have been exposed to be included in that national study for PFAS. The particular exposure assessment that I just mentioned is one where it was a pretty narrow scope, And so I think that we're hopeful that they can get these homeowners who have changed residence and are now not living in the area, but had, you know, most likely had PFAS exposure from drinking the water for so many years, to be involved in that study. So I would encourage those people to contact our Kent County Health Department so they can get put on a list. So when that exposure is, health study, national health study, goes underway, that we have those an opportunity to connect with those people later on.
Rick, should we be talking to our doctor about our potential exposure?
I've talked to my doctor, just not because I don't think I've been, you know, exposed that much, but I'm concerned about people wanting to get that information and how physicians should respond. And if there's no specific level in the blood that mean, just like cholesterol or something like that, that you know, if you have such a level of cholesterol, you know, you're more likely to have a heart attack. It's not quite that clear, but there are levels that if you're at a certain concentration, you are definitely more likely to have certain symptoms. It's not quite as direct as cholesterol or some of the other factors, but I think if you you know, feel that you've been exposed and then been exposed more than just the average person, all of us have PFAS and PFOA in our blood at about 2 parts per billion, and we're concerned about parts per trillion in the drinking water. So that shows how it's retained in our bodies. But if you're exposed through drinking water, the levels in your blood can go back, can be as high as what was present in people's blood back in the year 2000, when we were using these chemicals all the time. So I think you need to have that dialogue with your physician. There is information on the ATSDR website, and it's a simple matter of watching for being a little more careful about cholesterol and other symptoms, screening for prostate, testicular cancer more aggressively. And the biggest concern I have is fetal and young childhood health, and I think that's the area that really needs to be watched. The reason why the levels are going down is because we're seeing definite effects with the fetus and with child health, especially immunity and things like that. So pediatricians need to be aware of that. So even though you don't have a number associated with your blood, I think you can talk to your physician and just mention what types of diseases are associated, what types of symptoms are associated, and just watch for those.
Did hear that there was some training for the doctors for PFAS that was ongoing through Kent County Health Department as well. So I think the information is getting out to the medical community as well on some of those things. But like Rick says, I'm not sure that they're going to be able to pinpoint certain things. But at least if you know you were exposed, you can talk with those appropriate medical professionals.
You know, I've heard quite a bit in the last year and a half or so around this idea of blood testing. People want to get their blood tested, and they're confused, I think, by some of the messaging that's come from health authorities. You know, the state health department and local health departments, not just in Kent County, but in Kalamazoo, Calhoun County, I heard this quite a bit when parchment, you know, was discovered. And this, you know, they're being told essentially by health authorities, you don't worry about blood testing. We can't interpret the results once we get them, so you know, we're not encouraging you to go get that test. And you know, a lot of people hear that and go, well, you know, it confuses them. And you know, now the state is trying to undertake this exposure assessment here in Kent County, where they do need blood testing, and they're having difficulty getting participation. And I don't necessarily know if, you know, I think it's fair to say that there may be some, you know, connection there for, you know, a year's worth of health authorities telling folks, you know, blood testing is not necessary, you don't really need to go do it, we can't interpret the results. And then when it comes time to actually do an exposure assessment where blood testing is necessary for sort of the population level data that it can yield, then suddenly people aren't showing up and they're not, you know, the participation is become difficult. And I think to some degree that's potentially, you know, a result of, you know, this year's worth, you know, a year of telling people don't worry about blood testing.
Okay, so we've got a nice conversation starter here. We're going to turn the questions over to you now. Chrissy has the microphone. Raise your hand if you have a question, and we'll start taking your questions. I did want to talk about one of the things I found interesting in Wixom. There's a manufacturing plant. They actually put in a reverse osmosis to try to get their wastewater reduced in PFAS, though they kept getting really high levels at the sewer plant. And it turns out this stuff is just lined on the pipes. It's not being flushed out. It's just staying there forever. And it's going to be a very, very long time. Because in the meantime, that's all going into the Huron River.
Right.
Yeah.
They had problems with mercury in the past where people would use mercury for manometer switches and things like that, and it would be in the factory pipes, and it would take a long time to get out. So you definitely have to treat it more aggressively. Activated carbon, you know, is a good treatment method. But the Huron River is another plating. It's another plating company that discharged up in the headwaters, contaminated the entire watershed. And I'm sure that when I was at University of Michigan, I was getting it when I was, you know, drinking the water there, because all the water comes out of the Huron River. So,
But it does make an interesting, I mean, it's pretty time intensive and expensive for these companies who even when they know they're discharging PFAS because they've been using it for years to undertake this. These plating companies, you know, they're really not, high-end industries. They're not going to be making a ton of money. So to change out a plating bath, they don't have to just change out the chemicals that are in the bath. They actually have to take and basically buy a new vat, because the PFOS specifically does kind of stick to the inside of this. And so even if they change out the chemicals that are in there, they will still get measurable amounts of PFOS that are leaving the plant because of it. And so it's very difficult to switch over. You know, they will have entire plating lines that are thousands and thousands of dollars worth of chemicals sitting there. So it's very expensive for them, and they can't do it very quickly. So the one in Wixom has taken almost a year to try to get it all figured out and clean out as much of the plant as they can. And then, like you said, we've still got some of the discharge issues.
We've got our first question. Please tell us your name and what town you're from.
Hi, my name is Bruce Carlstrom, and I live in Rockford. And I'm wondering what concerns I should have about skin exposure from, let's say, showering in PFAS-contaminated water.
Do you have a house that has PFAS contamination, or?
So our neighbors were tested, and it was below the standard.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think dermal contact is significant at higher levels.
Okay.
It's something you should be aware of, and if you're above the drinking water standards, then you know it's something that I would be concerned about.
You know, something
we're,
that
we're finding more about dermal contact. Dermal contact was kind of written off, and all of a sudden there's been some studies that show dermal contact is a little more significant. So we have issues with the PFAS foam, and they're already saying, you know, don't contact the foam in the river. So I would just be wary. If you're have low concentrations, it's probably okay.
So one of the things that I have heard, and Rick, maybe you can speak to this, but that, you know, the molecules dual aerosolize. Mm-hmm. And so if you're taking really hot showers that get super steamy, that might be more readily take up, through just sort of breathing those molecules in a steamy shower than you might if you were taking maybe a cold shower, that sort of thing.
Mike colleague Rebecca Williams actually asked that question of Elsie Sunderland. That's the Gordon McCabe Professor of Environmental Chemistry at the Harvard John A. Paulson School of Engineering. She basically said dermal contact, direct uptake through the skin, is thought to be quite small risk, but there's not a lot of data to support anything. No. That's why we saw early when the Huron was found to have PFAS, they said, you know, just don't ingest the foam. And then a few weeks later, they said, actually, don't touch it. And so we're still learning about these. This
there was
family
a recent conference in Boston, and Dr. Brimbaum, one of the people that's in charge of regulating that, mentioned dermal contact as something that you know, we shouldn't write off. We do need to study it more.
Yeah.
So,
which is part of the reason that we've posted the signs and had a Wolverine post the signs along the Rogue River, because, you know, while people aren't going to be swimming in the Rogue River every single day for 70 years, we don't know, you know, how much is sticking to their hands if they go get out of the river and go by the ice cream cone. How much are they ingesting? So we just want people to know that it's there. We want people to take precautions. There's hand washing stations. So we're trying to at least err on the side of caution until we can better understand the science.
Yeah, and that's something, you know, washing hands in this case is really important. If you've got little kids and your carpet happened to be treated and those kids are down on the floor playing, make sure that they wash their hands before they eat or before they put anything in their mouth, because they can be ingesting this and you wouldn't even think of it being in your home and your carpet like that, but it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's in a lot of our household products. I mean, we've got, you know, scotch guarded carpets, scotch guarded couches, Teflon pans, you know, Gore-Tex clothes. There's just a, you know, the products that use PFAS and all of those chemical compounds are wonderful. We really like to use them in our industrial society. It makes our lives really easy, but there is a cost to that. And so I think those are the kinds, that's the part of the science that still needs so much more development. We don't even begin to understand all of the potential exposures associated with just our everyday life.
Yeah, if you have Teflon and you don't want to give it up, the two things they say, don't overheat those pans, because if they get super hot, they'll let off. Also, if they're scratched, throw them away. Get something different.
Yeah. And just because it says PFOA free, you know, they're not making the old style Teflon pans anymore, but they still can use fluorinated polymers. You know, it has to say fluorine free, not just PFOA free. So you've got to watch what some of the products are labeled as.
Got another question?
My name is JJ Lowe from East Grand Rapids, and I'm wondering if you had a magic wand, what would you ask for from support from the state government as well as the federal government?
Do you want to take that one?
Stump the panel.
It's a good question. You guys, there's so many. There's really, I mean, the ubiquity of this stuff is no joke. And, you know, there's, you know, it's easy to say, well, we need more money. And because that's true. The, you know, not just for testing and mitigation efforts, filters, that sort of thing, but, you know, eventually we're going to have to get to the point where we got to clean this stuff up. We got to dig it out of the ground, or we've got to start pumping the contaminated groundwater out of the, you know, the aquifer. So the easy answer to that right now is just, you know, sort of a blank check, right? You know, if you're asking for a magic wand. You know, I guess if I had that magic wand, you know, and setting aside the monetary concern or those issues, I might ask, you know, the state or federal government to move more quickly and potentially start taking, you know, steps along, you know, based on what's known as the precautionary principle in public health, which is the idea that you don't have to wait until every little thing about a harmful substance is known before you start taking serious steps. It's sort of the flip side to the idea that, well, you know, prove to me that there is harm before we start doing something. And so I guess if I had to wave that magic wand, it would be a money thing and a mindset thing.
If I had a magic wand, which I do, I have two in my office. sometimes I use them on my staff so they can tell you all about it. You know, I think what I would really wish for is a better sense of unity, both at the state and federal level. You know, Michigan is trying to forge ahead. We've got, you know, we're one of the few states in the country that has an actual state enforceable regulation for PFOS and PFOA. That puts us out on the cutting edge of a lot of things, but it's not a very easy road. It would be so much nicer if we could get EPA to either designate this as a CERCLA contaminant, a RCRA contaminant, set an MCL, something, so we had a more unified action across the entire country, because it's pretty hard to regulate it here in Michigan but not have all of the other states participating, because I think we, you know, we still get products from other states. We still get products from other countries. And so just, you know, this is a great place to start, but it's just really the tip of the iceberg. So I really see the need for better communication, better collaboration across our entire country and hopefully our world, because this is, like I said before, this is a perpetuity issue. This isn't going away. Even if we don't give it money today, our grandchildren will have to give it money 200 years from now. And that's just not something we've ever really thought about in environmental contamination. So I would definitely use my magic wand up.
Rick, you got a magic wand?
Well, I would have two waves of the magic wand, or I'd want two things. One is regulating PFAS chemicals as a class and as a hazardous substance. We do that with chlorinated pesticides. You know, we can design all sorts of chlorinated molecules, but they all turn out to be bad. Brominated flame retardants, we've been making those for a long time. We've been making all different formulations out of them. Every one of those has turned out to be bad, so we don't do brominated flame retardants anymore like that. We really need to consider those materials as a class, as hazardous compounds. The carbon-fluorine bond is the fourth strongest bond in nature, and the fluorine molecule has all sorts of, it's electronegative, so it's very charged. And that material, like I said, binds to a lot of bioproteins, and it's something that really shouldn't be circulating. Any compound that circulates in our blood that comes from our products is not a good idea. So I'd like that to happen. And the other one is something for everybody in this room, and we really need to have more people demanding PFAS-free, fluorine-free products. And I just look at BPA as a great example. I remember, you know, 10 years ago that we would have BPA water bottles, and there was some pretty convincing science that came out, just as convincing as the science that we have now, and it was being used in baby bottles and baby nipples, and babies were being exposed to BPA much more than they should have. And once that got out, nobody wanted BPA bottles. And you can't buy a BPA water bottle anymore. I mean, every bottle says BPA free. So I think as consumers, we have brominated flame retardant free car seats for kids. I mean, that was one of the problems where our children in auto car seats were just bathed in these brominated compounds. And that's all been taken care of. We need to, as a group of citizens, ask for fluorine fluorine, demand fluorine-free packaging in our foods, fluorine-free dental floss. There was just an article a couple of months ago about people that use the ribbon dental floss that really slides through your teeth. I use it all the time because I have teeth that are close together, and the but people that use it have higher levels in their blood. So, I mean, we don't need those kinds of compounds. So I would want more activism to, as consumers, to have not have those materials in our products.
Next question, please.
Ian Purvis, Rockford resident. Given the multiple contamination sources that Garrett mentioned, how straightforward is it to identify where the contamination came from in, say, a specific well, private well? And to what extent is that giving a lot of wiggle room to the responsible parties?
Good question. So that gets back to some pretty heavy-duty science. We have to basically follow that trail back. So if we get, we've done a lot of sampling across the state for the municipal drinking water supply, and samplings for schools, and sampling for other, you know, large users. And so we have been able to basically trace back some of those, you know, hits in drinking water wells that we didn't really know were there. So we use the geology, we use information that we have on chemical users in the area or other spills that we know about. We take basically a profile of everybody we know of. So we'll look at, is there any fire stations in the area? Are there any platers in the area? Are there anybody that's using PFAS chemicals that we know of? And try to trace them back. So we really use what we call multiple lines of evidence to try to pinpoint where we think the most reasonable discharge is coming from, where it might be impacting that well. So using all that, if we can define who it's actually coming from, and the real catch of this is not showing where it came from, but if the company is still around to actually make it right. Michigan law is, you know, if the company's out of business, then it's basically what we call an orphan site. And so there's no one left to take care of it. We have a causational standard in Michigan under Part 201 for liability, which means if you cause the contamination, you're responsible for cleaning it up, which is great, but we also have a lot of industry that turns over, considering we're still talking about, you know, environmental contamination from 50 years ago, 100 years ago, or more. And so there are those, there's those spots in our law that it's weak, where if we don't have a responsible party, or we don't have someone to actually clean up the contamination, then it falls back on the state to do. And so that's why the state of Michigan, Eagle specifically, has taken on a lot of these investigations, because we don't have, you know, the small plating facilities, the small manufacturers, they're gone, and there's nobody left to do it. So we have taken it on. So the legislature has given us money not only for PFAS response, for evaluating all of the PFAS exposure across the state for municipal drinking water, for doing some of this landfill testing. We're doing the study on the plating facilities. All the municipal wastewater plants have been tested. So we've got a pretty good cross-section of what we understand about our thing, but then we're going into those situations where we're really looking at specific wells and specific areas for targeting down to who's causing what. And then we'll have to work on how, you know, how we prioritize that, because that list is pretty long.
One thing I wanted to mention, piggyback on that, is that there's some ability, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but for scientists and regulators to do what's known as fingerprinting, mm-hmm. On the results in, say, your well, right? So if you get if you have a contaminated well and you get it tested, you know, there's anywhere from 6 to 24 versions of PFAS that they test for, and, you know, there is some ability, I think, for to be able to say, okay, so there's high levels of PFOS and PFOA and PFHXS, right? And then the PFHXS tends to be a marker for firefighting foam contamination, right? And so that's sort of a clue that, okay, maybe there's other sources of PFAS in the area, but since we have high levels of PFHXS in this particular well, then that's going to direct us to look towards, you know, any releases of AFFF in the area, that sort of thing.
So let me jump on that. Let me jump on that one. So Garrett makes it sound very easy. It's not really that easy. He is right. There is a lot of study being done to try to do exactly that, to do the fingerprinting. But that is only easy if you actually have a sample of the original compound, if you actually know what was dumped. So in the case of Wolverine, we know that they would have changed their formulations, and 3M themselves would have changed their formulations in the way they developed the PFAS Scotchgard for 60 years. That's how, you know, basically from 1950s on up through 2009, when the Rockford Tannery stopped, they would have been using PFAS formulations from 3M the whole time. So all of those formulations would have changed, plus the tannery operations would have changed. And so you really need to understand what the original compound and formulation look like, because I'm not a chemist. I leave that to some of these other guys, but the way it's been described to me is that this electrofluorinization process is very messy chemistry. They end up with about, you know, 70-80% PFOS, PFOA, that's what they want. Mm-hmm. But the remaining junk around the edges is just that. They don't know what it is, and they don't really even care, because it makes great Scotchgard, or it makes great Teflon, or whatever. And so it's really hard for us as environmental regulators to do any fingerprinting that's going to really be worth. It's not going to be our first line of evidence, let's put it that way, in court. Plus, it's pretty darn expensive at this point. It's more like saying the way they've got the laboratory analysis right now is to do more of a gross mass and say, okay, we know you have a very large mass of PFAS chemicals here. And so they're not at the point of actually saying, okay, you've got 20% this, 50% of this. They can just take that large body and kind of measure it there. Do you want
to
add anything?
Yeah, I would say we're probably about 5 to 10 years away from being able to reliably fingerprint the PFAS compounds. We do that with PCBs all the time, but we're not anywhere near doing that. There's a lot of similarities with that. The real problem you have is when multiple people have dumped in discarded waste in a certain site. You know, like state disposal, is that Wolverine's PFAS, or is it people that dispose of their carpet in the landfill? I mean, it's hard to pin it on one person. So when you have the tannery site, you know, you can say that's Wolverine, or if you have the Kent County Airport, you know, that's the firefighting foam. But when you have sites with multiple uses, like Boulder Creek or other ones, it's going to be really hard to differentiate who's PFAS is where.
Especially when it's going into surface water bodies. Yeah. If you've got multiple discharges at multiple points along a river, there's going to be no way to really define without measuring out the groundwater discharge into those surface waters as to whose PFAS is whose.
Let's get the next question.
I'm reticent to talk about the politics of this, but I think that it's important for us to understand whether or not the new administration is going to be helpful in disclosing all of this information and doing something about it. So,
are you talking about the federal level or state level?
State.
State.
So I'd like you to discuss that with us for a moment.
Could you, I guess, elaborate on that a little bit. You know, are you questioning?
Seems to me that Flint was an R problem that they ignored, and hopefully that the D problem will actually do something about it. What do you think?
Well, I think it is encouraging to see that the state, you know, or at least the Whitmer administration, is moving forward with the MCL process. I think you heard us mention that earlier, the maximum contaminant level, which is, you know, when we write about it and in the news, we call it a drinking water standard. That was something that, I guess, sort of the seeds of it began under the Snyder administration. And then, you know, Whitmer, when she came into office, she continued. She kept MPART. She rearranged it a little bit and moved it underneath DEQ or EGLE. But she's propelled it forward, and she's sort of trying to, it appears like she's trying to do it on a fast track to some degree. And so I guess it's always a little fraught to get into some of this political stuff, you know, one administration versus the other. But
I think you can say, though, I think state government learned a lesson because of Flint. I mean, a lot of people lost their jobs, and I'm quite proud to say that the work by my colleagues at Michigan Radio were responsible for a lot of those jobs being lost, because
Lindsay Smith.
Lindsay Smith is one of them, Mark Brush, Rebecca Williams. They had to show the governor's office, no, what you're saying is wrong, and here's why. Here's what it is. Here's what's in your documents that we got from your office, and had to show them that that they were lying, even though they kind of thought that they were getting by with just a little spin, and it was not spin. Anyway, I think the Flint debacle made a lot of people in politics and in government in general in Michigan realize we got to toe the line better than what we've been doing. I hope that's the case anyway.
I'll give you my two cents. Having worked in the department for the last 28 years, I don't think I've ever seen such good bipartisan support for a contaminant or any kind of response in state government. So, you know, we've done a lot of different things over the years. We've had a lot of different administrations. I've had, you know, four or five different governors, six different directors, some of which don't even like us, but they're our directors. And so at this point, we got really good support for MPART and for what we needed for the PFAS response under Governor Snyder. We're getting equally as good of response under Governor Whitmer. And I don't see that changing. I don't see that that her administration is going to change that at all. So we're still getting the funding from the legislature, both from our Republican side and Democratic side. And we've gotten really good support on both sides of the aisles for, at our town halls and our meetings and stuff. So on this particular issue, I haven't really seen it. Now, if you ask me about some of the other stuff, we can talk afterwards. But and I will say, the Flint issue was a huge turning point, not necessarily always for the better for us. And I know from the outside looking in, it looks like it was a revolutionary type of thing, but not so much because you're still getting 150% of every staff person's time and energy to really do the right thing. But now we're all working under somewhat of a fear of having to report all of our emails and all of our actions to Garrett or to somebody else who's going to be questioning every single little thing. And so the fact that you could get prosecuted for doing your job is a little daunting some days. And that perspective is one that most people wouldn't have unless you've actually sat in that position of having to not just defend the state's actions, but what I wrote in an email because, Garrett's going to do an article or we've got some other science coming out and somebody, is worried about it. So I think that part of it's been very difficult for us as the state employees to handle.
Next question, please.
Hi, it's Mindy Miner. I live in Rockford. My question is, in order to clean up this mess, I understand we have to come up with a way to break these fluorine bonds, and there's been some research on that, but I just wondered if you could talk about how close are we to coming up with a solution, and will it ever be affordable?
We're pretty good at trapping the molecule on carbon, but you're right, we're not very good at destroying them. And when you destroy them, you wind up with fluorine, which isn't, or fluoride, which isn't very good. So we're kind of at a dead end with that. And we really need to look at how we can, you know, get rid of those chemicals, because there's even questions on a lot. The carbon has to be regenerated by heating it and burning it, and there's questions on whether when we send the carbon back after it's been used for water treatment, whether we're actually getting rid of the PFAS, you know, through incineration. So that's a big hole, and we're working on that.
Yeah, we should explain that a little bit. So a lot of water systems use carbon granular activated carbon filters, right? And that can catch these long chain PFAS molecules. After a while, it does less and less job. So they'll take that carbon out of that filter pit. They'll send it off. It's superheated, and then they recycle it. They use it again. So it's recycled granular activated carbon. So we haven't been doing that very long, so we don't know how effective that's going to be on PFAS. Mm-hmm. Is that correct, Rick?
Yeah.
I'm not a chemist either, so I just want to be sure.
No, they're very hard to get rid of, and it takes a lot of electricity. It takes a lot of electricity to form the compounds, and it takes, you know, a lot to break them apart.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've heard, that's a question a lot of people ask, because, you know, how are we going to clean this up, and what happens with the byproduct, you know, once we have cleaned it up? So once we get it out of the groundwater, what do you do with that? I'm not entirely sure how to answer the question of where it goes, because there's a lot of companies such as Calgon Carbon that have some kind of proprietary process where they regenerate the activated carbon and send it back to the water treatment plant. I did want to mention that there is, in other parts of the country, they're starting to look more closely and find evidence that, you know, the incineration of these compounds is probably not an ideal thing to do in terms of, unless they're being captured at the stack somehow, because they do get into the air. And I think it's down in North Carolina, there's been some documented instances of contaminated groundwater where the only possible source was air deposition. So it was, you know, PFAS molecules going out of a smokestack and landing, you know, over an area and, you know, contaminating that area. So I think there's at the national level, there's some concern about incinerating and what the byproducts of that are.
So I'll just add in to go back to the treatment technology. There is one of the good things that's coming out of MPART is there is a whole lot of vendors that are coming to us daily saying, I have the best thing for PFAS. I have a way to destroy it. I have a way to deal with it. And so we've actually got an MPART treatment technologies work group that's working on that, and they have put together an actual consortium of these vendors and of these treatment technology proprietors that are coming up with new and innovative solutions for PFAS. So we're right at the beginning of that issue, and I think for some of our bigger issues like Wolverine and where we've got 50 acres of sludge, then we're really talking about not destroying it, but trying to trap it, trying to encapsulate it so that it doesn't move anywhere, because you can't just let that stuff leach into the groundwater for the next 100 years, because we're going to be dealing with it for so long.
I want to step back just for a second and point out that we're talking about PFAS and that family of chemicals tonight, but we've been dealing with the same kind of issue with PBDEs, with PCBs, with dioxin, with mercury. These are all things that, by the way, are in our fish along with PFAS in some areas. And so a lot of these chemicals, it's going to take decades, if not hundreds of years, to eliminate them from our system. So they're not going to go away, just like some of these legacy pollutants have not yet. There are fish in this state that have DDT, mm-hmm. high levels of DDT. We haven't used that chemical for a very, very long time, and it's still sticking around. So the PFAS is just the latest. It might be all on our minds right now, but there are a whole bunch of them out there.
Hi, I'm Jen. I live in Plainfield Township.
Mic.
Yeah, that mic's not working. Okay. Hi, my name is Deb, and I live in Plainfield Township. And we have pretty much, I guess, according to the township, reduced to like trace levels of PFAS in our water through the municipal system. But I'm wondering about two other sources. One is Versluis Lake, which used to provide water, and apparently was so contaminated they had to stop drawing for that, from that rather, for our well. And the other is the North Kent landfill. And there's a lot of confusion about just, do those continue to be threatening sources? Like, for example, we have a triathlon race in Versluis Park, and people are all, you know, like, should we, shouldn't we? How do you make that judgment call?
So we've done testing for Versluis Lake for the surface water, and it did have pretty low levels. My memory serves me correct. I want to say it was like about 6 parts per trillion in the surface water for PFOS, PFOA. So we're not considering that to be a major source. What you're referring to is the Versluis well field, which was a group of pump wells that the Plainfield Township was using just north of Versluis Lake that they actually drew the water out. But it was more of a, basically drew water out of the Grand River and out of the ground. And so you had a strong source of PFAS that was getting into one of those 6 wells, which is why they had to shut down that well field. They're no longer using that well field for Plainfield Township water. And then the second question was North Kent landfill. We've also done testing up there. Kent County, that is the responsible party for the North Kent landfill, so they are also doing testing. We've done the. It looks like there are some PFAS that are coming out of the landfill, but not, you know, 100, 200 parts per trillion compared to some of the surrounding areas where we've got 10,000, 20,000, 30,000. So it looks like it's a small source, but it is not a major source. That being said, it is true that Wolverine did dispose of waste in North Kent landfill, but it is an aligned cell and it's got a cap. And then that leachate that comes off of that is collected. And last I knew, they were building a treatment system for that leachate to be filtered through the granular activated carbon, so it wasn't going to be discharging, because that goes to North Kent Sewer Authority, who also doesn't want the PFAS in their stuff. So the end, where to stop this cycle is going to be one of the hard parts of this, because we can't just put it in our landfills, because then it comes out as leachate. Well, the leachate ends up going to our wastewater treatment plants, who then, you know, if they aren't filtering for it, it then passes into our biosolids, which gets back onto our farm fields, which ends up back in our groundwater. So it becomes a very vicious cycle. And that's why the collaborativeness of MPART, of our Michigan PFAS Action Response Team, has been so important, because we have to figure this out together. We have to find the solutions as one collective body, because there is no one agency that has all the right answers. You know, Eagle can't make moves without allowing our ag partners to weigh in. We can't make a move without allowing our fires marshal office to weigh in. There's just too much complexity and interconnectedness with this issue to go it alone, so we've really got to rely on each other.
So here is where we're at. We've got about 5 minutes left. I want to give these guys a chance to make one final statement. We'll take one more question, and then we're going to have to wrap up.
Yeah, oh no. Hi, my name is Lynn McIntosh. I'm from Rockford, Michigan. I find myself concerned, sorry, just let you hold it? Let control go here? Okay. All right. The 25% of people who are on private wells, I find myself very concerned about them. I don't know if many of them are here, but with the M part, I think it's great that 75% of municipal wells have been tested, but 25%, that's one in four people in Michigan have private wells, and considering what Lester Graham just said, we're talking about other things besides PFAS in addition. I don't know if I'm correct on this. I think that's a signal to keep it short. I don't think that the health department, Kent County, requires much in terms of testing for all of these kinds of things. And I think there's a lot of ignorance out there. People get their well report back, they buy a house, and they're testing for nitrates and E. coli, and we're talking about all these other things. Mm-hmm. And I would think a huge public service announcement made statewide, I said it out loud at a public meeting, everybody in Michigan should be able to affordably test their wells, their private wells, everybody.
Okay, do you have a question? We need.
Yeah, I'm starting to get on my little roll.
That's okay.
That my question is, what's going to happen? What's going to propel that? Is it on the radar?
Well, I think PFAS starts the ball rolling, because I think you're right, Lynn. We have let that obligation go. You know, the public buys a house, they have a private well. Some of them don't even realize they have a private well. They just don't get a water bill, and so they don't even realize what they're drinking. But they don't have any idea of what could be entering their well. And that's really, it's up to the homeowner to take care of your own well. There are no state regulations that require you to do any sampling of your private well. Maybe there should be. It comes down to money, right? It's always about money, because these tests aren't cheap. Right now, a PFAS test for your home, it could be about $300. You add in a volatile organic chemical test, which would probably be another $150. You're talking about Michigan 10 metals, pesticides, herbicides. You know, you could be $1,000 worth of testing. And, you know, when you add in those costs, you know, your realtor's market, your... Everybody's going to have a little say in that. So it's a public education thing, but I think this might be the thing, this might be the issue that starts that ball rolling and at least starts the public discussion about what should be required for people's wells at least every 10 years, right? Mm-hmm. We should get some basic rotation of testing. So you get your well tested and you know whether or not you're drinking. You know, my house was on a potato field, so I'm fully expecting that I probably got some low-level pesticides, herbicides, sitting in my water, maybe some naturally occurring arsenic, because we've got a lot of arsenic in our area. But I've also got a filter for PFAS, because, you know, I'm not that far away from Wolverine either.
Mm-hmm. Let's wrap it up. Rick, any final thoughts?
Well, I just want to emphasize that these materials are not like any contaminant that we've dealt with in the past, just because they're water soluble. They circulate in our blood, and they can potentially interfere with a number of hormonal systems. And our hormones function at part per trillion levels. And because we have that concentration capacity already, our levels in our blood are parts per billion. So again, I'm concerned about these as being a hazardous materials class, and we should regulate them as such.
Abby?
If I had my magic wand again, I would love to have somebody get into the chemical lobbyist group and start talking about testing these chemicals before they get put out onto the market. That would be my wish, but that's not my field, so if anybody else can do it. Garrett, maybe you can do it.
What she's referring to is TSCA reform. The acronym is TSCA, so for any of you who are interested in that, I guess. I guess I'm going to sort of echo what's been said, in regards to, you know, take the threat seriously. Lynn, and sort of in to your question, I wanted to let people know there is a a lower cost option here in Michigan for PFAS testing. Not too many people know about it. It's through an organization called Freshwater Future, and they partner with the University of Michigan Biological Station. And I think if you Google search that, the cost is, I mean, it's not cheap, but I think it's more in the realm of like $60 to $100. You know, it may just be simply testing for PFAS, not all the, you know, volatile organics and other stuff. But if you're worried, it might be an option. I think it's not. I think it's DIY testing in some case, so you take the sample yourself, and that means it's probably not admissible in court if you wanted to use it for that reason. But nonetheless, if you're, you know, maybe it's an option for some people. I guess for the final thing I wanted to say is that, you know, at a national level, there's a lot of legislation right now, actually. Congress is paying pretty close attention to this. Tomorrow, there is a big hearing, sort of competing with the Mueller hearings. But, you know, while that's going on, there's a woman from Belmont that will be, you know, on Capitol Hill testifying. Her name's Sandy Winstelt. She lives on House Street. Some of you may know her. And so, you know, I guess that is encouraging to see that, you know, the legislative branch at the federal level is taking this pretty seriously, and, you know, on a somewhat of a bipartisan basis. And so, you know, I think that gets to the fact that, you know, everybody kind of these things always encourages you, call your legislators, call your representatives, you know, make your voices heard. Well, you know, this stuff, these bills, there's something like almost 20 separate pieces of legislation around regulating PFAS at the federal level are pending in some form. And, you know, that's kind of indicative of the fact that there are people who are doing that. And so it is worth taking that 5 to 10 minutes to make a phone call, send an email, do that, reach out to your elected officials.
Our panel's been Rick Wadeski. He's an environmental toxicology and chemistry professor at Grand Valley State University. Thanks for coming in.
Sure. Glad to come.
Abby Hendershot is the district supervisor at the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy Eagle in the Grand Rapids District Office. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Garrett Ellison is an environment reporter for MLive Media Group. MLive, I will tell you, and Garrett are my competitors. But this guy has done such an outstanding job in covering this issue. His group, and Gardner was involved in it as well, but his group has done a really outstanding job. It's journalism like you hope journalism would be. It's been fair, balanced, inquisitive, demanding, and it's getting things done. So I really would like to just say thank you.
Thank you, Lester, and thank you all for that. Appreciate it.
And thank you all for coming out. This has been a good crowd. I know I've done a lot of these. I think this is one of the most important topics we've ever had to tackle. I wish we didn't have to tackle it, but I'm glad that there's a lot of people in this community who care enough to come out and ask questions and listen to the experts as they speak. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
One more quick announcement. The waitstaff here has been working really hard tonight. Big round of applause for them, and make sure you tip them well. On your way out tonight, stick around. You can have another drink or whatever. Hang out for a little while. Feel free to pick up some Michigan Radio swag on your way out the door. And thanks to Garrett for a forward promote. Michigan Radio will air the Mueller hearings tomorrow live starting at 8:30 a.m. So if you want to hear those, tune in at 104.1. Thanks, everyone. I'm going to go to the next one.